I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
This episode of LiveWire is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, and then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Welcome to LiveWire, everybody. I'm Luke Burbank. How's it going? We have a totally unique episode of the show for you this week. Here's what happened. A couple weeks ago, our executive producer got a call from some folks at an organization called Lampedusa. Lampedusa is a group that raises money for refugees around the world. It's named for an Italian island that has had a lot of refugees show up because of its proximity to Northern Africa. So anyway, these Lampedusa folks, they mentioned that they had put together this benefit concert that was going to be traveling around the country. And it was going to have all these amazing performers, people like Brandi Carlile, Patti Griffin, Dave Matthews, Steve Earle, among others. And they asked us if we would be interested in maybe doing an interview with one of these performers, probably from a recording booth somewhere. And we were intrigued. We were thinking about doing it. But then we looked at their tour calendar and we realized they were coming to have the concert in Portland, which is where we do LiveWire from. So we got this idea. We asked the Lampedusa folks if it would be okay if we just went backstage at the Aladdin Theater where this was going to be happening. And we set up a little like makeshift recording booth. And then we would just try to grab these, I'm going to be honest, like pretty famous singers as they were on their way back and forth from soundcheck. And surprisingly, the Lampedusa folks said, sure, come on down. So that is precisely what we did. And this hour, we've got those conversations that we recorded backstage for you. It's going to be fascinating. How do I know? Because I was there when the conversations occurred. And let me tell you, it was interesting stuff. Here's how we're going to kick things off. With a true legend of country music, none other than Emmy Lou Harris. Over the past half century, if you can believe it's been that long, Emmy Lou has been delighting fans all over the world. She's won like 13 Grammys. She's been inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame. But when she sat down with us backstage at the Aladdin Theater, she explained that there's actually still one musical accomplishment, one honor that still eludes her.
They still don't play me in the truck stops. I don't know why.
You've
or
got
in
to
Cracker
be kidding.
Barrel. You just cannot. Now, Whole Foods. I'll hear myself in Whole Foods, but not in Cracker Barrel. I still got that Final Frontier ahead of me. I know.
The Flying J.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a concerted, is there a concerted effort to keep Emmy Lou Harris certain
institutions?
It's
just something that I thought about at my last visit to Cracker Barrel, which I love, by the way.
So you like Cracker Barrel, but you were in there and you were reflecting on the fact that you're not hearing Emmy Lou Harris.
No, I've been playing country music for years. You know, when you're lucky enough to make your living doing something that you love, you just want to be able to give back. And of course, in my own community, I have my own animal rescue. I'm very much, I suppose that's my primary passion is animal rescue. But we need to rescue people too.
You grew up in a military family, right?
Yeah, my father was a career Marine for 30 years.
And yes. He was a prisoner of war in Korea?
In Korea for 16 months. He was shot down shortly after he got there.
I don't know if you follow this stuff, but you know, there's been a lot in the news about the NFL and players speaking out against institutional racism in this country as it relates to the national anthem and the flag. And a lot of people, I think, have conflated these protests with a protest against military service or sacrifice. Do you have a thought on that, having grown up in the family you grew up in?
That's a difficult question because I honored, my parents are my heroes. And I had difficulty being active against the Vietnam War because my father served in World War II and the Vietnam War, and he was sent to Japan to do a tour of duty during Vietnam. I respect the players, right? And there was that one player who knelt and put his hand over his heart. And I think that kind of, it put it all into perspective. We love our country, but it is a work in progress. And the first thing we have to do is acknowledge when we get things wrong and when there are problems that we have to fix. But our right to protest and is sacrosanct in this country. So,
did you start to develop what I think people think of as being a fairly progressive worldview? First of all, would that be an accurate way to describe your politics?
What
and how
is that? A progressive worldview?
Well, I mean that you seem to sort of try to look out for humankind. When given a chance.
I think most people do. I think most people have a chip for compassion in them that's very powerful. I think they do, and we get numbed sometimes by a feeling of helplessness because there's so many things going on in the world that we know need fixing. But I don't see how we can live in the world as it is today and think that we can isolate ourselves from every, because there are things in the world that are going to come and bite us, you know, whether we, you know, no matter how many layers we put around ourselves. I mean, I think it's best to approach it from a humanitarian, compassionate way. But if not, at least try to look at it in practical terms and see, you know, what the consequences of doing nothing or of being a part of the problem are.
I guess I'm wondering, you know, you grew up in this military family. I know that you kind of knocked around New York and other places as you were, you know, learning your craft. And was that where you sort of picked up a worldview? I mean, how did you become Emmylou Harris, who we think of now as a very socially conscious person?
But do you remember the 60s? I mean, remember, that wasn't that long ago. There was a point where we really thought that we could change the world. And all of us who witnessed, I wasn't at Woodstock, but, you know, I was on my way there. I just couldn't get close.
You hit traffic?
No, I got married.
That's like the world's biggest traffic jam.
Yeah. So, you know, we believed, I mean, the Imagine came out of that. You know, the song Imagine, it's a secular prayer, it really is, for the world and for humankind. We may never get there, but, you know, don't we have to at least lean toward the light a little bit? There's nothing more satisfying than the opportunity to feel that you've actually made a difference for someone, even if it's just little acts of kindness. So, you know, who knows? I was raised by two people who were extraordinarily loving and kind to each other. My father was a career Marine, but he was a good father. He was a good son. He was a good neighbor. He believed in fairness. I saw their brilliant marriage of two people who respected and loved each other. I mean, whoever I am came from the seeds of that, you know. And so I was very lucky. I didn't have to overcome the dysfunctional family that apparently everybody says they have. I came from the functional family.
You were the one.
I was the one. It was my family. And so I've been blessed in every aspect of my life. And so I want to give back. And of course, I have the great satisfaction, too, of having my own little dog rescue, which is very small. But and it's one dog at a time that would normally have probably been euthanized, and we find homes for it. So on a microcosm level, I'm able to do that on a day-to-day basis, just out of where I live, you know, in my particular home and my particular spot on this earth. And so being able to get out and become a part of something globally, you know, I'm happy to be here.
What do you think? You've won, I think, around 13 Grammys. You're in the Country Music Hall of Fame. What do you think has made you so successful in this business? What sort of, you have a special talent or a personality trait? What has served you well doing this all these
years? Resilience. And I don't know how to do anything else, so I have no choice.
What is your favorite song that you're playing right now?
I don't really have a favorite, although recently, you know, I'm in the middle of a tour, and I've started doing that old 60s song, Abraham, Martin, and John. Do you remember
that?
Yeah,
of course.
Because I think we're longing for some kind of leadership right now as Americans. And of course, it's nostalgic for me because it was, you know, it came out when I was a teenager and the 60s, and that brings it all back. And it was terribly, I mean, I remember everything. I remember the Kennedy assassination. I remember where I was, the news about Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King. And we really thought that it was the end of the world, but you see, it's not.
Is that maybe where some of your optimism comes here in 2017?
I think I'm just naturally optimistic, but with a just a nice, healthy hint of cynicism. I think it's kind of important to have both, but you lean a little more toward the optimism. Didn't you love the things they stood for?
That is the legendary and, like, shockingly down to earth, Emmy Lou Harris, right here on Livewire. I'm Luke Burbank. This week, we are bringing you a series of backstage conversations recorded at the Aladdin Theater in Portland, Oregon. And coming up after the break, Dave Matthews. Yeah, that Dave Matthews. One of the most successful American musicians in decades. Talks about what it's like to be on stage when everything starts to go very wrong.
You know, if I was going to be complete honest, I might just throw my guitar down and, you know, go running off screaming. So that's not, for me, I don't consider that an option.
Don't go anywhere. That is coming up on Livewire from PRI. Livewire gets support from Fully. Hey, do you sit motionless behind a desk all day? I know, it's not great, right? It's why everybody these days is getting those standing desks, because your body is meant to move, and no amount of after work yoga and downward dogging and cross-fitting or whatever you do can undo the damage of being at your desk all day. That is where Fully comes in. Based in Portland, Oregon, they make and sell desks and chairs that have changed my life. Because right now, I'm actually sitting on a TikTok stool as I record this. And my body is engaged and the blood is flowing. And I am so creative. Can't you just hear it in my voice how creative I am? They're also the folks responsible for the Jarvis sit-stand desk that I use when I am hosting Livewire at the Alberta Rose Theater. And they are the exclusive U.S. carrier of the Capisco chair that I also use when I am hosting the show. Listen. I'm not telling you not to do yoga. I'm not even telling you not to wear yoga pants. Also, say namaste if you want. I'm just saying, you don't have to do your body in by sitting still all day in a traditional chair in front of a traditional desk. Head over to Foley.com/LiveWire to find out about all the cool stuff they're doing. Welcome back to LiveWire from PRI. I'm Luke Burbank. Okay, this week, we set up two microphones on a coffee table in the very creaky, it turns out, backstage area of the Aladdin Theater in Portland, Oregon. We were there because a bunch of amazing musicians were all getting together to raise money for an organization called Lampedusa, which helps out refugees. By the way, the recent estimate is that there's something like 65 million refugees worldwide. So this is a crisis that needs everybody's attention. One of the people giving some attention to it is none other than Dave Matthews. Now, you got to understand something about the career of Dave Matthews. For the period of about a decade, his band sold more tickets and made more money than any other band in North America. Like, they would sell out these huge venues for an entire weekend, and thousands of people would come just to see them. Like, they're all there for the Dave Matthews Band. It's amazing, actually. So when I sat down backstage with Dave Matthews at the Aladdin Theater, I was wondering what his mental preparation is for something like this, where there's like 700 or 800 people that he'd be playing for in just a couple of hours.
I think playing in this situation is sort of, for me, because I don't play like this very often, is incredibly liberating, and I feel very vulnerable, but at the same time, very safe. Because it doesn't matter if I turn things upside down or I squeak, because it's just me. And I'm also with these people that I think that are all sort of some of my heroes, musical heroes. When I play with a band, it's a different experience because it's like a machine. And there's a great deal of love in it, but the love has taken a lot of time. And it's like juggling together. It's like playing. It's almost, in some ways, it shares something with a sports team. You know, it's like this. There's a knowledge of what everyone is capable of. And I know how carefully my drummer listens to me. I know who is going to follow me if I do this. And I know who I can follow. And so it's much more of an organized chaos. And when we're at our best, it is an elating sense of power and belonging. And when we're not communicating, it is a deep and dreadful nightmare.
And yet you're up there on stage in the midst of a deep and dreadful nightmare, trying to stay joyous and trying to give everybody their money's worth. Like, how do you keep those two thoughts in your head at the same time?
Well, humbly in some ways, but even on a hard night, I know what I'm serving. And that's an audience, you know, and I want to be honest, but if I was going to be complete honest, I might just throw my guitar down and, you know, go running off screaming. So that's not for me. I don't consider that an option. So if I feel like I have, like I'm tied down by whatever my own brain or whatever it is, or miscommunications, that doesn't stop the fact that my first responsibility is to do as much as I can to have people leave thinking That was an emotional, amazing, uplifting experience. Because there's enough darkness in the world that I don't need to come out there and dump it on everybody. If I have a little bit, just because I have a microphone, whatever the song or whatever the topic, I just have to give everything I can to the audience.
The organization that you're all here donating your time for is an organization that helps refugees. You obviously did not grow up as a refugee, but you did move around a lot as a kid. Did that in any way make its way into your music or your approach to life, just being in different places, living in South Africa, living in the US, living in the UK?
Yeah, I certainly think the way that I write music and the way I play music is, I'm sure I'm just imitating things I've heard. It's just how maybe the how I play them may not look that way, but for me, everything I've heard, it sort of contributes to what I make. But I think traveling around, if that's done anything to me, is sort of reassuring to think that people are essentially the same wherever you go. And by that, I mean, everybody wants to feel a sense of security. Everyone wants to feel a sense of belonging. And that doesn't need to be to a large group. It doesn't need to be to a fashion. It just a sense of belonging, even in a place. And everyone needs to feel that they have space. Even if it's the tiniest amount of space, but that they have space to exist. And it's a common thing. And we all want joy and we all want those things. But I think that one of the things that I'm confident of is that of the 65 million people that are displaced in the world, just a little bit less than 65 million of those people are good people. And that we should assume that about all of them. And that the people that have a place in the world and the people that have a home, like us, need those people. Because the more people that we have around us that belong, the more people that can make a better world.
That's Dave Matthews of The Dave Matthews Band, right here on LiveWire. LiveWire is brought to you in part by Alaska Airlines. Now, people may think Alaska Airlines only flies from cold to colder, but with 1,200 daily flights and 118 destinations, Alaska Airlines is a gateway from the West Coast to the world. Learn more at AlaskaAirlines.com. This is LiveWire. I'm Luke Burbank. This week, we are talking to some amazing musicians who would all come through Portland, Oregon in support of an amazing organization. The organization is called Lampedusa. It's named for an Italian island. Just Google it. It'll all explain itself. But what Lampedusa does is they work to improve the lives of refugees around the world. Earlier, we talked to Dave Matthews. We also talked to Emmylou Harris, who I found out all her friends call Emmy. Anyway, shortly after Emmy had left our little makeshift recording area, we were able to talk to none other than Patty Griffin.
Smile on your face. I live on the sea.
Now, Patty grew up one of seven kids in Maine, and she bought her first guitar when she was 16. It cost all of $50, and it turned out to be money well spent, because Patty turned out to be a rare, albeit shy, talent. She's won a Grammy, she's had all kinds of musical success, and in turn, she's used that platform to support causes that she believes in, like Lampedusa, which is how she ended up sitting on a slightly ratty couch with me backstage at the Aladdin Theater talking about refugees.
I come from immigrant grandparents, as so many of us do in this country, and it's personal to me. I think that without the immigrants, I don't think the United States would be a very interesting place to live. You know, poor people have... they know how to improvise, and they got great ideas. And clearly our government isn't interested at the moment in doing what all that can be done to help with the situation on the globe. But if it isn't done, what will come from 65 million plus people without a home on the globe, wandering this planet with nobody giving a damn? It will continue on for many, many, many generations if we don't deal with this.
You were one of seven kids?
Yeah.
I was two.
What number?
I'm the oldest and you're the youngest?
I'm seven, yeah.
That's a lot, right?
You've got... yeah. It was a lot. Well, my mom had ours in 7 years, too. So she had, she
That's
started.
Irish twins.
She did. She had Irish twins. God bless her.
Yeah. Wow.
So she was busy. And I think it was great for me. I got left to my own devices a lot and sort of created my own little world and doing what I want to do. No one was paying attention. So I ended up doing this.
Did that drive you towards like artistic stuff and music and things like that?
I think so. I think that's in my DNA. I think my mom was a really great just singer, but not professionally. And her mom is a great singer and just sort of passed down through their world. And then I'm half Irish, and that's just all about music, right? So I think that it just kind of, yeah, showed up.
But I read that you, as a, you know, teenager, maybe you weren't thinking about trying to have a music career. But then I read that in your 20s, you started like playing in coffee shops in Boston and things like that.
Mm-hmm. I was really, really shy. And I had been told along the way that I could sing, but I don't carry a lot of natural confidence. That may be from being an immigrant, you know, like second generation American. I think that, you know, I come from people who are from humble beginnings, and you stay humble and you try to get a job. And so I think doing this is something I had a really big struggle in my 20s, trying to just accept that this is what I could do and it was okay to do.
Because of shyness or because of not feeling like it was a legitimate line of work?
Shyness, not feeling like it was a legitimate line of work, possibly from my family background, and not really having anything to say yet. I think that, that when I got a little older, the songs became a little more interesting. So that's part of it too. You practice that songwriting and then suddenly something inhabits the song. Took a while for that to, for me to happen.
When did it start to feel like it could be something that you really did? You started getting attention from the record industry, or what was the kind of breakthrough moment for you, if it even happened that way?
I was about 29 years old, and I had been married, and my marriage kind of fell apart. I separated from my husband.
Well, now you had something to write about.
Well, that's true. But I also recognized when certain things happen in your life, you realize you have to be yourself and you have to do what you want to do. It's almost like coming out. Yeah, I want to be a musician. You know, I'm just going to do this. Everybody calm down. What turned into my first record was me making demos.
There's a song off of there, which like really resonated with me growing up with a lot of kids and not a lot of money. Poor Man's House. I was wondering, was that autobiographical?
Yeah. You know, both of my parents wrote poetry and I didn't know that. I kind of snuck a peek at their poetry at one point in my 20s and got in trouble for it. But one of the lines from my mother's poems was a line about my father having torn up all of the daylilies in front of her house. She will absolutely kill me if she ever hears this. But she said that Larry pulled up all the daylilies in front of the house. He thinks it makes it look like a poor man's house. And I know what she's talking about. I think when you're raised poor and there's discrimination that happens, you try to sort of always hide it. And I think my father in particular grew up with discrimination for being poor. And my mother too, but my father was Irish in Boston in the 20s and 30s. And that was a difficult time. So anyway, it sort of sprung out of that story.
Were your parents pretty blown away by your musical success when you, you know, started to be a real professional musician and there you are, you know, performing for the world? You've won a Grammy. I mean, you've done a lot of things. Was that impressive to them?
If they keep it to themselves for the most part. They give me a little bit of encouragement here and there, but they never really said, yay, we're so excited for you. I can tell they are, but it's not in their nature to be exuberant about that.
That
sort
is
of
the
thing.
Most interesting kind of parent. And I feel like I come from a similar family where it's very loving and very supportive, but also, you know, I threw out the first pitch at a Major League Baseball game and my mom wasn't going to come because she worked at Costco and she had to do the samples. And she was like, I got to break down the pierogi station. It's really time consuming. I'm probably not going to be able to make it. And it really keeps you,
yeah,
keeps you kind of hungry.
And you know what? She's right. It's just a gig. It's just a gig. It's your gig. And it's a great gig, but everybody's got a gig. The guy that picks up the trash, he's kicking butt on his gig, and no one's patting him on the shoulder for that. And I think that it's an equalizer, having that attitude. And I'm glad that I was raised that way, although I could have used a little bit more encouragement here and there.
Do you feel like, do you feel at this point with all the success you've had that you're less shy, or do you, is there still some 22-year-old part of you that thinks you're going to be found out?
Well, I'm getting older, thank God. One of the things that comes with getting older is not giving a damn what people think. That's lovely. I think I'm always going to be a shy person. You know, I can't sit here and not feel like a little knot in my stomach. You know what I mean? That's just being, I think some people are just born shy. That's me.
You know. Every little skinny sheep. So count your ribs and say your prayers and get to sleep. Nothing is louder to God's ears than a poor man's sorrow. Daddy is poor today and he will be poor tomorrow. Hey, that's the poor man's house.
Everybody, that's Patty Griffin here on Livewire. If you'd like to catch her and the rest of this Lampedusa tour, it is not too late, my friends. They're going to be in El Paso on October 14th at the Abraham Chavez Theater, and they will be in Dallas at the Majestic on October 15th. Livewire is brought to you in part by Whole Foods Market, who partners with farmers to help ensure no meat in store has added hormones or antibiotics. Because the words mystery and meat don't need to apply to this week's lunch. Whole Foods Market. We believe in real food. Well, hello there, semi-mysterious Livewire listener. We've got a very basic five-question survey on our website right now that we would very much appreciate you taking. It takes literally 15 seconds. And we want to know a little bit more about you. We want to find out who's listening to the show, what you guys like, what you don't like. We promise it will not be stalkerish. But seriously, filling out the survey will help us secure sponsorship. It'll help us with grant funding, which will let us keep doing the show, which is a really important part of what we do. Continuing to do the show, that is. Here's how you help out. Head over to livewireradio.org/podcast and click on the big red survey button at the top of the page. You cannot miss it. It's the red button that says survey. In doing so, you're going to be automatically entered to win a Livewire totes bag, which is, of course, a totes bag that actually says totes on it. Be the envy of all your friends. Oh, and also, you'll win a Livewire t-shirt in the totes bag. Thank you so much for helping us out. Again, head on over to livewireradio.org/podcast and help us with the survey. It will take less time to take the survey than I just took telling you about the survey.
I'm just a pilgrim on this road, boys. I'm just a pilgrim on this road, boys.
This is Livewire from PRI. I'm Luke Burbank. Okay. On this show, I know that I spend a fair amount of time recounting all of the trouble I got into in my younger days. And let's be honest, my not so younger days. But my life has nothing on Steve Earls. Stephen Fain Earl was born in Fort Monroe, Virginia, but he grew up in San Antonio, and he left high school early for Nashville, seeking work as a musician. And thanks to being super talented, he actually found it. But he also found a lot of trouble. Trouble with drugs, trouble with alcohol. He had seven marriages. Steve Earl packed a lot of living into his 62 years. And throughout it all, he's been very openly political, even at times when it probably was hurting his career. He stood up for unions. He opposed the death penalty. He identifies as a pacifist. Lots of things that you might not see as a natural fit with country music. Something else surprising about Steve Earle, who grew up in the South, he's actually a huge New York Yankees fan. And so after his sound check at the Aladdin Theater in Portland, where we had set up a little backstage recording booth, we had to send somebody to go grab him off the tour bus because he was out there trying to find a TV so he could watch the baseball game. Anyway, we finally corralled him into our recording area and we got down to talking.
When you were starting out making music, what were your aspirations to be able to make a living playing music?
To get girls originally. I mean, I was in Texas and I didn't play football. So, you know, it was really that simple at first. But then when I actually got my hands on a guitar, it was kind of over.
But you bounced around a little bit, if I read right, right? Like you dropped out of high school and you moved. Is that right? To kind of
get a change of scenery? I dropped out of high school and went to Houston and, I met Towns Van Zandt and kind of followed him around Texas for a while. And then I figured out he wasn't going to ever lie to anywhere. And I could see him a lot of places. And I went on to Nashville when I was 19.
And what was Nashville like for you back in those days? What were you doing? Writing music?
Yeah. I mean, I had a publishing deal before I was 20. And, you know, everybody thought I'd have a record deal by the time I was 21. But the inmates were sort of in charge of the asylum when I got there and the window closed. You know, the powers that be sort of reeled things back in and got them back under control. So I didn't quite get a record deal in time.
Patty Griffin was talking to us and saying how she felt like when she was young, she didn't have enough to write about. She hadn't lived enough. Had you lived enough by 19 or 20 to really write?
Yeah,
stuff?
When I was 20 years old, I wrote, sometimes I still do. I wrote Tom Ames Prayer when I was 20, and I wrote Ben McCullough when I was 20.
Really?
But I did it by, you know, making up stories that were completely and totally, you know, out of thin air, you know.
That seems to be an argument against this idea that if it's not lived experience, it won't feel authentic.
I've never bought the idea that you had to go out and abuse yourself in order to write. I never believed that, even when I was abusing myself. I just did that because I did it. It didn't, you know, it doesn't make sense that you do something that dulls your wits and that you're going to be able to do really hard mental work better. That never made sense to me. So I never bought that for a second.
Do you feel like your very public activism for causes that you value, do you think that has impacted your career at all?
Sure. Sure, it's cost me record sales, ticket sales, sure. But I'm okay with that.
Any dark nights where you think, oh, man, I could have just maybe moved a couple million more units and set myself up for good?
I don't think like that. I think I met Towns Van Zandt when I was 17 years old, and I realized I'd met somebody that was making art for the sake of art and didn't really think about the money part of it. I made a lot of money, and I spent and lost most of it, and I got married too much to keep any money. And, you know, I still got a small child, and he has autism, and that's expensive. And I'm not going to ever be able to retire. It's a good thing I don't really want to. But, you know, I wish I could be home with him more at this point in my life. But I do all the other stuff that I do just kind of keep from going to hell because I've managed to make an embarrassing amount of money for a borderline Marxist doing something I really love doing. And you know, I think you have to go out of your way to try to put something back when that's the case.
And this is part of that, I would assume.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How did you end up starring on the TV show The Wire?
David Simon's a fan. He's a big music fan. And he had another series, a mini series called The Corner before The Wire. And he used a song of mine as the theme. And then when he was writing The Wire and came up with the idea of who was going to be this guy that sponsored Bubbles when Bubbles tried to get clean, he just got the idea that maybe I could play this character, and we'd never met. He called my manager, and I read for it in a recording studio. Then,
were you nervous at all to
do
that?
I was terrified. I was terrified. Yeah, but it didn't really require any acting because I was playing a redneck recovering addict. So I was doing something I did all the time as a matter of life and death. I was my first scene in The Wire. I'm the speaker in a meeting, and I'd done that. You know, I'd been clean for, you know, 8 years or something like that, you know. I'm recognized for it all around the world by people that never have bought one of my records.
Right. And I think a lot of people, they thought, I like this guy Steve Earle on this TV show. They didn't even know.
No, I didn't. Especially the black folks that I run into that recognize me from, they don't listen to my records. So it's like, you know, But I'll never forget, I was speaking at it's the detox at Bellevue in New York. And I was, you know, we speak in this room, and it's the TV room. And there was guys that just couldn't wait for the meeting to be over. They were in the meeting, but they were really waiting for the TV. And then we're, you know, I'm talking to another guy that came out and talked to me after the meeting when the meeting's over. And these guys get the TV and they turn it on. And by that time, you know, The Wire was being rerun on BET. And I looked up and there I was on the screen. I said, I need to get it out of here. You know, it's like, this is going to get weird.
They're going to think that you're like an actor who's been hired to come in.
Oh, no, I'm walking down the street sometimes and a guy will yell at me across the street. Hey, man, thanks for helping out Bubs. It happens, you know, on a fairly regular basis. Because there are some people that think television's real.
You're under no obligation to answer this question, but what is sobriety like for you 23 years in versus 23 days in?
It's been harder the last few years than it probably has the whole time that I've been sober, but that's basically because of stuff that's been going on in my life. So, you know, but I still do the stuff that I started out doing, which is going to meetings and calling my sponsor, and sponsoring people is what saved my butt the last few years. And because if you sponsor people, then you can't go back out, because then you go, they'll read about it in the paper. Because if I go back out, I'll be dead in a matter of days. And it's just like, that's where my disease left off. And that's what they told me if, when I came in. That's if I went back out, it would be right back where it started again instantly. And I believe it, you know. So I don't want that blood on my hands of somebody reading that saying, oh, that, see, this doesn't work, and going back out. So I'm not going to do that.
What do you hope your legacy is when you're all done with this?
My legacy is going to be the Galway girl in Ireland. I know that much. And they won't remember me, but they'll remember the song.
How about you as a person? Like when people talk about Steve,
I don't know whether, you know, it matters what your legacy is as a person. Like, I don't know. Like I operate on a handful of principles on a day in, day out basis. And I'm not sure they change that much when I'm dead. And that's the idea that your opinion of me is none of my damn business.
I took a stroll on the old long walk of the day. I met a little girl and we stopped to talk of a fine soft day. And I asked your friend, what's a fella to do? Cause her hair is black and her eyes are blue. And I knew right then, I've been taking a whirl around a salt-tailed prom with a call.
That's Steve Earle, and this is Livewire. This week, coming to you, mostly anyway, from backstage at the Lampedusa concert, benefiting refugees as it stopped through Portland, Oregon. All right, coming up after the break, singer Brandi Carlile on the pressures of fame that nearly ruined her voice.
It's interesting when your name stops meaning just you anymore. That's when the butterflies came on.
That's in a moment. This is Livewire from PRI. Hey, this week on Livewire, we'd like to thank some very special members. Of course, I'm talking about Jennifer Cruikshank of Portland, Oregon, and Christy Stagg of nearby Vancouver, Washington, just across the river. Support from members like Jennifer and Christy is a hugely important part of how we are able to make Livewire week in and week out. So thank you, Jennifer and Christy, from the bottom of our hearts. Welcome back to Livewire from PRI. I'm Luke Burbank. This week, we're bringing you a series of conversations that we recorded on the same day backstage at the Aladdin Theater in Portland, Oregon. A bunch of amazing musicians had gotten together to raise money and to draw attention to an organization called Lampedusa, which supports refugees around the world, primarily through free education, which sadly is actually a rarity in a lot of places. Now, Brandi Carlile got her musical education at a very early age. She grew up about an hour outside of Seattle in a family of musicians.
It really breaks my heart to see a dear old friend go down to the worn out place again.
And her first real gig was actually singing backup for a local Elvis impersonator.
One of the little girls I sang at the musical theater called the Northwest Grand Ole Opry, Amber Lee. Her dad was the Elvis impersonator, and I was learning harmonies from my brother, and I was teaching her some of them because obviously Elvis Presley had the greatest harmony singers in the world. And so I was able to kind of get a little summer job as a teenager singing backups for Elvis.
Did you have a number where you felt like you really got to shine as the backup singer?
Trilogy.
Trilogy. I don't even know that song.
Oh yes, you do. The American Trilogy.
Well, what's
glory, glory, hallelujah.
I guess I never knew it was called the American. His Truth Is Marching On.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Wow.
But it starts with "Hush, little baby, don't you cry." So it's the trilogy.
How was this Elvis impersonator? Like, was it believable?
I feel like he was one of the best. He won lots of awards and spent a lot of time in Vegas, and my parents would never let me go, but he was pretty fantastic. He wasn't the greatest dancer, but he really had the vocals down. And he did Roy Orbison, too, in the second set of the show, and he would nail that as well.
The real double threat. So Elvis for the first part of the show and then come back out as Roy Orbison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Were you nervous as a young kid performing? I mean, did you get butterflies or did it feel real natural to you?
It felt really natural. I didn't really get butterflies until I was in my 20s. And that's when I started getting like a late stage fright.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you think brought it on?
I think suddenly feeling the responsibility for other people in my band and realizing there were people I couldn't let down.
Like Brandi Carlile Inc. was starting to form in a way.
Yeah. It was funny. I was just talking about this. It's interesting when your name stops meaning just you anymore. That's when the butterflies came on, when Brandi Carlile meant also Tim and also Phil and also whoever was playing drums.
How did you deal with the late onset butterflies?
It caused me a lot of vocal trouble because there's a vocal exercise I got really into called Melissa Cross, the Zen of Screaming, where basically the theory is that if you feel confident and comfortable with a note that you're about to sing, it can't injure you, even if it's a full-throated scream. But if you don't feel confident about the note that you're about to sing, you can tense and compensate in certain areas. It can injure you. So I think the nerves got me singing wonky for a little while. But it only took about 4 or 5 years for me to get past it and start finding ways to calm down that weren't whiskey.
Because that'll do a different kind of number on your throat, right?
Yeah, but that's actually quite a lot safer than nerves.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you having fun getting to pal around with some of these legendary artists? And are there tips that you feel like you can pick up? I mean, you've been performing for a good while yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say I pal around with them as much as I just sort of stare at them awkwardly and you know, hope that they'll say hi to me and things like that. No, it's really amazing to be included. And I definitely feel the most honored to be on stage, I think.
Just being around and observing somebody like Emmylou Harris, do you learn about the music business and about the being a human business just from kind of being near that?
Yeah, you know, every time I've talked to Emmylou, it's always been about some kind of activism, some kind of outreach, something that's important to her. And I really appreciate that kind of interaction. And then, of course, it's impossible for her influence not to show vocally. It's always been a part of how I sing and express myself. Emmylou Harris is just in there.
Well, a similarity seems to be, too, that she has been, throughout her career, really active in social causes. And I know that you have, too.
Yeah.
Stuff that's important to you. You raise money for it. You draw attention to it. You talk about it. There are some people that feel like, you know, musicians and athletes and people, like if you're not a politician, you should stay in your lane. Do you ever get that kind of feedback? And what do you say to that? Like to people that think, your job as a singer is to sing songs and to do that, but not to get involved in all these other causes.
Yeah. I mean, I do get that. Of course, we all get that a lot. I mean, people think that artists are supposed to be there to entertain them and to give them respite from global issues, difficult issues, and to only rally them together for things that are positive. And so you definitely feel a lot of pressure to dilute your message so that you can stay the entertainer. That's something I'm up against all the time. But it's not a sentiment that I agree with or believe in. So I've had to kind of power through it and overcome it in a lot of different instances, because it's not that I feel that I've earned a platform like a preacher or anything, but I cease to be authentic or any good to anybody if I don't express my feelings and my beliefs and if I don't engage within my activism.
What's a favorite song of yours right now that you're performing? Is there a song that you really look forward to when you're playing a show?
Oh man, you know, I always sound so silly saying this, but it's always The Story. I always love singing the story. It never
gets
old.
That's nice to hear, because that's a huge hit for you. And usually people, when they have a huge hit, they immediately start hating the song.
I don't think it's ever a huge hit. Like, that's the thing. I don't think I've ever had a hit, but the story was a victory to me when I was first told that I could sing it, because it was written by one of my brothers, Phil. I'm in a band with the twins. And when I met him, he had had that song. And I said, you know, there's a song that you have called The Story, and I will just die if I don't get to sing it. And so he gave me permission to sing his most precious song, and I don't think I've ever stopped being grateful for that.
I think that song was number one in Portugal.
You go, you're exactly right.
So don't say it wasn't a hit.
You're exactly right. That was a strange phenomenon in Portugal.
What was it about the Portuguese that really vibed with that song?
There's a couple things. One of them is that it was in a really cool television commercial. The other one is that they're so emotional and outward, and the story is just loud. It's not holding back with its love, and I think they just kind of reacted to it.
It would appear that this is a journey that you've been on for a lot of your life. You started out singing pretty young, mm-hmm. probably had dreams of a career in music, and now you've done it. Does it feel like you thought it was going to feel?
It feels like I hoped it was going to feel, and I always felt successful. People will tell you that, like, I felt like I was famous when I was 12 years old. I would do my autograph, and I would sing, like, karaoke, and I would feel like I had always arrived in my mind. So everything that ever happened past, like, you know, winning a karaoke contest when I was 13, I was just bonus. You know, as long as I was doing it and people were reacting and people would listen to me, I was really happy. So every time something happens, if I get a Grammy nomination, if a really special show sells out, if I get to meet somebody that, you know, I really look up to, I'm just totally overwhelmed by it all the time and feel very normal in a very odd situation.
What song did you sing at the karaoke contest?
I used to love doing so many of them, but like, Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me, the Elton John and George Michael version.
When he says, when George Michael says, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Elton John, and the crowd, makes me feel emotional when I hear that sometimes. It's like the most cool moment.
I know. And it's like, George Michael is one of the best singers like in the world ever. But when you hear Elton John's voice in that second, the Don't Discard Me, when you hear him say Don't Discard Me, it's like a mile wide. It's the thickest, most profoundly powerful voice. When it comes out of his mouth, you're just like, oh my God, that's Elton John. And so I used to do that one. And I loved the drama. So I used to also do The Show Must Go On by Queen.
Wow. Ambitious.
My makeup may be fading, but my smile, and a purple blazer. I was like,
where were you performing these songs at as like a teenager?
Like Eagles Lodges and bars and like dive bars. And my parents would just like drink and like we would just sing karaoke. I mean, they would let you in.
That doesn't sound totally legal.
Or safe, but it happened.
And here you are today.
Yeah.
With the number one song in Portugal for at least a period of time.
See, like I don't have no normal thing has happened to me as far as success goes. Everything's just a little left to center.
Is it more fun that way in a way?
Oh yeah. It's really fun.
All of these lines across my face tell you the story of who I am. So many stories of where I've been. And now but these stories don't mean anything when you've got no one to tell them to. It's true, I was made for you.
That's Brandi Carlile. That's going to wrap things up this week on Livewire. Thank you so much to everybody who helped make this special episode possible, including our guests, Emmylou Harris, Dave Matthews, Patty Griffin, Steve Earle, and Brandi Carlile. Livewire is brought to you in part by Alaska Airlines, Whole Foods Market, and Fully. Special thanks this week to Gail Griffith, David Robinson, Jillian Santella, and Carolyn Rosenfeld. Robin Tenenbaum is the executive producer and co-creator of Livewire. Laura Haddon is our producer and editor, and Melanie Sevchenko is our assistant editor. Molly Pettit is our technical director. Our development director is Lauren Masterson. Laura Harden is our marketing director. And our operations manager is Tim Harkins. Additional funding by the Oregon Cultural Trust and the James F. and Marion L. Miller Foundation. LiveWire is made possible by the generous support of our members. This week, we'd like to thank member Megan Woodard of Portland, Oregon, for her support. For more information about our show or how you can listen to our podcast or sign up for our newsletter, head on over to livewireradio.org. I'm Luke Burbank. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Wouldn't it be amazing to have a piping hot episode of LiveWire delivered right to your heart and ears each week? Well, guess what? That can happen when you subscribe to the LiveWire podcast feed, and you'll get the joy of surprising conversation every week. So go ahead and do it. It's super easy. You click on the button at the top of your podcast app, and bam, you are LiveWire subscribed. And if you're still, you know, feeling the love, if you're enjoying the show, hey, maybe you could hook us up and leave us a quick review. That'll help more people find out about LiveWire. And thank you.
From PRX.